a Paramount release. Black lines cut horizontally through a gray screen. White letter fragments appear and assemble as the screen becomes all black. Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. The word psycho splits into three disjointed shifting fragments which are swept away by vertical gray lines. The gray lines drag new titles onto the screen, starring Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates, Vera Miles as Lila Crane, John Gavin as Sam Loomis, co-starring Martin Balsam as Milton Arbogast and John McIntyre as Sheriff Chambers, with Simon Oakland, Vaughn Taylor, Frank Albertson, Loreen Tuttle, Pat Hitchcock, John Anderson, Mort Mills, and Janet Leigh as Marion Crane. Screenplay by Joseph Stefano, based on the novel by Robert Bloch. Director of Photography, John L. Russell, ASC. Art Direction, Joseph Hurley and Robert Clatworthy. Set Decorator, George Milo. Unit Manager, Lou Leary. Titles designed by Saul Bass. Edited by George Tomasini, ACE. Costume Supervisor, Helen Kovig. Makeup Supervision, Jack Barron and Robert Dawn. Hairstylist, Florence Bush. Special Effects, Clarence Champagne. Sound Recording by Walden O. Watson and William Russell. Copyright 1960 by Shanley Productions, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Westrex Recording System. Assistant Director, Hilton A. Green. Pictorial Consultant, Saul Bass. Music by Bernard Herrmann. Directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Vertical gray lines sink into the middle of the screen. Now, in black and white, we pass over a sprawling city. A half dozen skyscrapers topped with antenna towers and signs are surrounded by shorter office buildings and homes which stretch across the flat landscape to low mountains in the horizon. Words appear. Phoenix, Arizona, Friday, December the 11th. As we descend into a cluster of 10-story brick buildings, the time appears, 2:43 p.m. We scan one side of a brick building and narrow in on an open window. We pass under a Venetian blind raised a few inches off the windowsill and slip into the room. Inside, we view two lovers. A shapely blonde woman lies on a bed wearing a knee-length white slip and a lacy white brassiere. She gazes up at a handsome, well-built man. Bare-chested, he wears dark dress slacks and has short black hair.
You never did eat your lunch, did you?
I better get back to the office. These extended lunch hours give my boss excess acid.
Why don't you call your boss and tell him you're taking the rest of the afternoon off? Friday anyway, and hot.
What do I do with my free afternoon? Walk you to the airport?
Well, you could laze around here a while longer.
Checking out time is 3 p.m. Hotels of this sort aren't interested in you when you come in, but when your time is up... Oh, Sam, I hate having to be with you in a place like this.
Well, I've heard of married couples who deliberately spend an occasional night at a cheap hotel.
When you're married, you can do a lot of things deliberately.
You sure talk like a girl who's been married.
Sam, this is the last time.
Yeah? For what?
For this. Meeting you in secret, so we can be secretive. You come down here on business trips, and we steal lunch hours. I wish you wouldn't even come.
All right. What do we do instead? Write each other lurid love letters?
I have to go, Sam.
She dresses.
I can come down next week.
No.
Not even just to see you? Have lunch? In public.
Oh, we can see each other. We can even have dinner. But respectably. In my house, with my mother's picture on the mantle and... my sister helping me broil a big steak for three.
And after the steak, did we send sister to the movies, turn Mama's picture to the wall?
Sam.
She glares at him in a mirror.
All right.
He holds out his arms and shrugs. She turns with a questioning stare, and he stands up.
Marion, whenever it's possible, I want to see you. And under any circumstances, even respectability.
You make respectability sound... disrespectful.
Oh, no, I'm all for it. It requires patience, temperance, a lot of sweating out. Otherwise, though, it's just hard work. But if I can see you and touch you even as simply as this, I won't mind.
He kisses her neck, then buttons his shirt.
I'm tired of sweating for people who aren't there. I sweat to pay off my father's debts and he's in his grave. I sweat to pay my ex-wife alimony and she's living on the other side of the world somewhere.
He gazes out the window.
I pay too. They also pay who meet in hotel rooms.
A couple of years and my debts will be paid off. If she ever remarries, the alimony stops.
I haven't even been married once yet.
Yeah, but when you do, you'll swing.
Oh, Sam, let's get married.
She throws her arms around his neck, and they kiss passionately.
Yeah. And live with me in a storeroom behind a hardware store in Fairvale. We'll have lots of laughs. Tell you what, when I send my ex-wife her alimony, you can lick the stamps.
I'll lick the stamps.
She gazes longingly into his eyes. Then Sam steps over to the window and turns to her with a heavy gaze.
Marion, you want to cut this off? Go out and find yourself somebody available?
I'm thinking of it.
Together, Sam and Marion start to smile.
How could you even think a thing like that?
Don't miss your plane.
Hey, we can leave together, can't we?
I'm late, and you have to put your shoes on.
Wearing a figure-hugging white blouse and long skirt, Marion leaves. Later, Marion strides past a portly man in a dark suit and enters an office where a plain-faced secretary sits at a desk.
Is Mr. Lowry back from lunch?
He's lunching with a man who's buying the Harris Street property. You know the oil lease man? That's why he's late. You got a headache?
Oh, it'll pass. Headaches are like resolutions. You forget them as soon as they stop hurting.
Have you got some aspirin?
Yeah. I've got something.
Not aspirin. My mother's doctor gave them to me the day of my wedding. Teddy was furious when he found out I'd taken tranquilizers.
Any calls?
Teddy called me. My mother called to see if Teddy called. Oh, your sister called to say she's going to Tucson to do some buying and she'll be gone the whole weekend. And...
Two men walk in. One wears a cowboy hat.
Wow. Hot as fresh milk. Hey, you girls ought to get your boss to air condition you up. He can afford it today.
Marion, will you get the copies of that deed ready for Mr. Cassidy?
Tomorrow's the day, my sweet little girl.
Marion looks up.
Oh, not you. My daughter. A baby. And tomorrow she stands her sweet self up there and gets married away from me. I want you to take a look at my baby.
He shows Marion a picture.
18 years old. And she never had an unhappy day in any one of those years.
Come on, Tom. My office is air-conditioned.
You know what I do about unhappiness? I buy it off. Are you unhappy?
Not inordinately.
She flashes a friendly smile.
I'm buying this house for my baby's wedding present. $40,000 cash. Now, that's not buying happiness. That's just buying off unhappiness.
He waves a stack of bills.
I never carry more than I can afford to lose. Count them.
I declare.
I don't. That's how I get to keep it.
Tom, a cash transaction of this size is most irregular.
Ah, so what? It's my private money. Now it's yours.
Suppose we put it in the safe and then Monday morning when you're feeling good.
Oh, speaking of feeling good, where's that bottle you said was in your desk?
The women smirk.
Oh. You know, sometimes I can keep my mouth shut.
Leaning close, he leers at Marion, then joins her boss.
Lowry, I am dying of thirst-a-rooney.
He swaggers into an office, and Lowry turns to Marion.
I don't even want it in the office over the weekend. Put it in the safe deposit box in the bank, and we get him to give us a check on Monday instead.
He joins Cassidy in the office and slides the door closed. Caroline hurries over to Marion's desk.
He was flirting with you. I guess he must have noticed my wedding ring.
The homely secretary flips through the stack of bills. Marion smiles and puts the money in a white envelope. She slips the envelope into her purse, collects some documents, and knocks on Lowry's office door.
Come in.
She hands him the documents.
The copies. Mr. Lowry, if you don't mind, I'd like to go right on home after the bank. I have a slight headache.
You go right on home, because me and your boss are going out and get ourselves a little drinking done, right?
Of course. Do you feel ill?
Just a headache.
Well, what you need is a weekend in Las Vegas, the playground of the world.
I'm going to spend this weekend in bed. Thank you.
Marion leaves Lowry's office and closes the door.
Aren't you going to take the pills? They'll knock that headache out.
Can't buy off unhappiness with pills. I guess I'll go put this money in the bank, then go home and sleep it off.
She takes her purse and leaves. Now in her bedroom, Marion stands in front of an open closet. She wears a black slip, and above her bare, thin waist, a lacy black brassiere supports her large breasts. A white envelope lies on top of her neatly made bed. Inside, we glimpse a stack of $100 bills, 2 inches thick. At the foot of the bed sits an open suitcase filled with hastily folded clothes. Marion selects a dress from the closet. Her dark eyes fix on the envelope as she pulls the short-sleeved dress over her legs and around her shoulders. She buttons the front of the dress, then adds a pair of slippers and a white slip to her suitcase. Buckling a belt around her slight waist, she gazes into a mirror. Her coiffed short blonde hair frames her high cheekbones, delicate dark eyebrows, thin nose, and full lips. She glances back at the envelope, then stuffs some final items of clothes into her suitcase. Glancing around the room, Marion steps over to a table and opens a small accordion file. As she flips through the documents inside, we glimpse the word auto on one of them. She stuffs the folder into a large black purse, then returns to the bed and latches her suitcase. Her eyes once again fix on the white envelope as she sits beside it on the bed with her purse in her lap. She stares away distantly and draws a deep breath. Tight-lipped, she opens her purse and forces the thick envelope inside. She hastily slips the purse onto her arm, grabs the suitcase from the bed, takes a coat from the closet, and leaves. Later, Marion drives down a city street with a preoccupied gaze.
Marion, what in the world? What are you doing up here?
Of course I'm glad to see you. I always am.
What is it, Marion?
Marion stops at an intersection and sighs heavily. She watches pedestrians cross in front of her car, including Tom Cassidy and Mr. Lowry. She trades a casual smile with her boss. Suddenly, he stops and frowns. Marion's smile grows flat as her thin, mustached boss reaches the curb and turns away. She drives through the intersection, swallows hard, and grips the steering wheel with both hands. With an anxiously knitted brow, she glances over her shoulder and drives on. As the sky grows darker, Marion squints into the bright headlights of oncoming highway traffic. Her dark eyelashes lower with a long, drowsy blink, and the screen fades to black. Daytime. Grassy rolling hills lead up from a lonely road where a black car sits parked beside a telephone pole. A passing police cruiser stops and backs up behind the parked car. The white doors of the boxy rectangular cruiser are each emblazoned with a star. A uniformed highway patrolman steps out of the cruiser and approaches the car in front of him. He glances in the driver's side window and spies Marion asleep in the front seat. He taps on the glass. Marion awakens and bolts upright at the sight of the stern-faced officer in dark sunglasses. She turns on the ignition.
Hey, hold it there.
Marion rolls down her window and gazes at the officer with wide eyes.
In quite a hurry.
Yes, I didn't intend to sleep so long. I almost had an accident last night from sleepiness, so I decided to pull over.
You slept here all night?
Yes. As I said, I couldn't keep my eyes open.
There are plenty of motels in this area. You should have... I mean, just to be safe.
I didn't intend to sleep all night. I just pulled over. Have I broken any laws?
No, ma'am.
Then I'm free to go.
Is anything wrong?
Of course not. Am I acting as if there's something wrong?
Frankly, yes.
Please, I'd like to go.
Well, is there?
Is there what? I've told you there's nothing wrong, except that I'm in a hurry and you're taking up my time.
Now, just a moment. Turn your motor off, please. May I see your license?
Why?
Please.
Marion lowers her eyes and turns her back. Shielding her black purse from the frowning officer, she stealthily removes the white business envelope and accordion file and finds her wallet. She takes out her driver's license and hands it to the patrolman. He steps in front of the car and checks Marion's driver's license against her Arizona license plate. With a somber frown, he hands Marion her license and nods. She stuffs everything back into her purse as the officer returns to his cruiser. Starting the car, she pulls onto the road. Marion's fidgeting hands grip the steering wheel as she scans the empty two-lane road before her. She glances in her rearview mirror and spots the police cruiser following closely behind. Marion bears right, taking an exit off the main road, which leads through more scrub-covered desert hills. She checks the rearview mirror, and the cruiser follows her onto the new road. Marion's nervous glances harden into a determined stare as she passes a sign, right lane for Gorman. A third car traveling in the left lane easily passes the police cruiser, which keeps on its steady course. Wrinkles crease Marion's smooth brow as she watches the cruiser in her mirror. Slowly, it bears right onto the Gorman exit. Marion's shoulders relax, and she lets out a deep breath. Later, Marion drives through a town on a busy four-lane road. She passes a mobile gas station, then carefully checks the traffic in her rearview mirror. She takes a right and pulls into a car lot decorated with pennants and packed with cars on display. Marion parks her big black sedan outside a clean, well-tended garage and gets out. Used Car Depot is painted above the office door. A trim man wearing a bow tie leans out and waves.
Be with you in a second.
Marion, still wearing her short-sleeved dress from the day before, peruses some of the cars on the lot. She notices their California license plates, then glances at her car's Arizona plate. Clutching her black purse to her chest, Marion strolls past a line of used cars. Their gleaming chrome grills and hooded headlamps sparkle in the sunlight. Quickening her pace, she reaches a newspaper dispenser. Finding a coin in her wallet, she slips it into the machine, lifts the clear plastic lid, and takes out a newspaper. As she reads the headlines, the highway patrolman rolls to a stop in front of the lot. He looks at her for a moment, then swings a U-turn and parks across the street. He steps out of his car and leans against it, watching Marion impassively through his dark sunglasses. Unaware, Marion opens her paper and reads as the salesman in the bow tie approaches her.
I'm in no mood for trouble.
What?
There's an old saying, the first customer of the day is always the most trouble. But like I say, I'm in no mood for it, so I'm going to treat you so fair and square that you won't have one human reason to give me.
Can I trade my car in and take another?
Do anything you've a mind to. Being a woman, you will. Is that yours?
Yes, it's... There's nothing wrong with it. I just...
Sick of the sight of it. Well, why don't you have a look around here and see if there's something to strike your eyes? Meanwhile, I'll have my mechanic give you the once over. You want some coffee? I was just about...
No, thank you. I'm in a hurry, and I just want to make a change.
One thing people never ought to be when they're buying used cars, and that's in a hurry. But like I said, it's too nice a day to argue. I'll shoot your car in the garage here.
He gets into Marion's sedan and drives it into the shop. Marion, having noticed the officer, glances across the street where he remains, watching her. Marion slips the newspaper into her purse and steps over to a used car. The salesman returns and lays his hand on the car's roof just above the 57 painted on its windshield.
That's the one I'd have picked for you myself.
How much?
Go ahead, spin it around the block.
It looks fine. How much would it be with my car?
You mean you don't want the usual day and a half to think it over? You are in a hurry, aren't you? Somebody chasing you?
Of course not. Please.
Well, it's the first time the customer ever high-pressured the salesman.
Oh, I figure roughly...
your car plus $700?
$700.
You always got time to argue money, huh?
All right.
His grin fades, and they lock in an unblinking stare.
I take it you can prove that car is yours. I mean, out-of-state license and all. You got your pink slip and
I believe I have the necessary papers. Is there a ladies' room?
In the building.
They start across the lot. He shoots her a sideways glance, and they both turn to see the officer across the street. As they near the office, he points to a door along the side wall.
Over there.
He stops and watches Marion go into the ladies' room. Inside the bathroom, we view Marion from above as she walks in and closes the door. Quickly, she places her black purse on the edge of the sink and takes out the newspaper. She unties the string on the accordion file and pulls out a document. Then she takes the white envelope out of her purse. Slipping off a rubber band and looping it around her wrist, she pulls out a stack of $100 bills and counts off seven. She returns the rest of the stack to the white envelope and takes a deep breath. Then she shoves the envelope back into her purse. The accordion file and newspaper follow, and she turns for the door. Outside, the salesman waits as Marion walks over with the money and the document.
I think you better take it for a trial spin. I don't want any bad word of mouth about California, Charlie.
I'd really rather not. Can't we just settle this and...
I might as well be perfectly honest with you, ma'am. It's not that I don't trust you, but...
But what? Is there anything so terribly wrong about making a decision and wanting to hurry? Do you think I've stolen my car?
Oh, ma'am. All right, let's go inside.
As they step into the office, Marion glances back over her shoulder. Across the street, the officer climbs into his patrol car. He checks for traffic, then drives across the road and onto the used car lot. He pulls in beside Marion's new car, a light-colored rectangular sedan. The officer gets out of his cruiser as Marion and California Charlie step out of the office. Marion spots him, hurries into the sedan, and gets behind the wheel. Charlie closes her door, and she pulls away just as a mechanic brings her old car around.
Hey!
Marion stops short. The mechanic, wearing a grimy uniform, carries her coat and suitcase from her old car.
Just put it in here, please.
He puts her things on the back seat.
Thank you.
Marion pulls away, leaving the mechanic, the salesman, and the officer staring after her. Later, she bites her lip as she drives.
Heck, officer, that was the first time I ever saw the customer high-pressure the salesman. Somebody chasing her?
I better have a look at those papers, Charlie.
She looked like a wrong one to you?
Acted like one.
The only funny thing, she paid me $700 in cash.
Marion glances down at her purse beside her in the front seat. Later that day, her eyes glaze over as she drives on the open highway.
Yes, Mr. Lowry.
Carolyn, Marion still isn't in?
No, Mr. Lowry, but then she's always a bit late on Monday mornings.
Buzz me the minute she comes in. Call her sister. No one's answering at the house.
I called her sister, Mr. Lowry, where she works. The Music Maker's Music Store, you know. And she doesn't know where Marion is any more than we do.
You better run out to the house. She may be unable to answer the phone.
Her sister's going to do that. She's as worried as we are.
At dusk, cars drive with their headlights on.
No, I haven't the faintest idea. As I said, I last saw your sister when she left this office on Friday. She said she didn't feel well and wanted to leave early. I said she could. That was the last I saw. Oh, wait a minute. I did see her sometime later driving. I think you'd better come over here to my office, quick. Carolyn, get Mr. Cassidy for me. After all, Cassidy, I told you, all that cash. I'm not taking the responsibility. Oh, for heaven's sake. Girl works for you for 10 years, you trust her. All right, yes, you better come over.
about to kiss off $40,000. I'll get it back, and if any of it's missing, I'll replace it with her fine, soft flesh. I'll track her, never you doubt it.
Oh, hold on, Cass. I still can't believe... It must be some kind of a mystery. I can't...
You check with the bank, no? They never laid eyes on her, no? You still trusting? Hot creeper, she sat there while I dumped it out. Hardly even looked at it. Planning and even flirting with me.
A sly grin plays at the corners of Marion's lips. Nighttime. Heavy rain streaks Marion's windshield. She turns on her wiper blades and squints as a steady stream of blurry headlights passes her going in the opposite direction. Marion blinks her wagging eyes against the relentless rain and bright headlights shining in her face. The traffic lessens, and Marion opens her eyes wide, straining to see even a few feet into the dark, driving rainstorm. She bites her lip as she scans the now empty road before her. The wiper blades push sheet after sheet of water from the windshield. Marion glimpses a neon sign off to the right. Turning off the road, she slowly approaches the sign, which cuts its message through the storm. Bates Motel, vacancy. Behind the sign stands a rustic single-story motel. A covered porch runs its length, and a welcoming light shines outside each door. Marion parks in front of the first door on the left. A warm light glows through its curtained windows, and a lit sign above the door announces, Office. Marion slides across the front seat, hurries out the passenger side door, and steps onto the porch. She walks into the office and glances into a dark back room. Finding no one, she walks back out onto the porch and spies a large house on a hill overlooking the motel. A single light shines from a second-story room in the foreboding Victorian mansion. Marion glimpses the shadowy figure of a woman passing by the illuminated window. With a hurried sigh, Marion returns to her car and presses the horn. The imposing house looms in the darkness. The front door opens. Through sheets of rain, Marion watches a wiry man hurry down three sets of stairs leading from the house to the motel. With a rolled umbrella in hand, he clasps his sport coat tight to his chest and joins Marion on the office porch. In his 20s, he has a thin, angular face and short, dark hair.
Gee, I'm sorry I didn't hear you in all this rain. Go ahead in, please.
Inside, he slips behind a desk and faces Marion with a pleasant smile.
Dirty night.
You have a vacancy?
Oh, we have 12 vacancies. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies. They moved away the highway.
Oh, I thought I'd gotten off the main road.
He opens a guest registry.
I knew you must have. Nobody ever stops here anymore unless they've done that.
He hands her a pen.
But there's no sense dwelling on our losses. We just keep on lighting the lights and following the formalities.
He watches Marion sign. Marie Samuels.
Your home address. Or just the town will do.
She glances at the masthead of the newspaper in her purse.
Los Angeles.
Numbered door keys hang on a board behind the desk. The young man's hand pauses beside number 3, then chooses number 1.
Cabin 1. It's closer in case you want anything. Right next to the office.
I want sleep more than anything else, except maybe food.
Well, there's a big diner about 10 miles up the road, just outside of Fairvale.
Am I that close to Fairvale?
15 miles. I'll get your bags.
He hurries out into the rain and takes Marion's coat and suitcase from the back seat of her car. She waits as he unlocks the door adjacent to the office and opens it for her. Inside, he turns on the light and sets her things down in the neat, simply decorated bedroom.
Boy, it's stuffy in here.
He unbuttons his sport coat and opens a window. Then he turns to Marion with a humble grin.
Well, the mattress is soft, and there's hangers in the closet, and stationery with Bates Motel printed on it, in case you want to make your friends back home feel envious. And the,
He switches on the bathroom light.
Over there.
The bathroom.
Yeah. Well, if you want anything, just tap on the wall. I'll be in the office.
Thank you, Mr. Bates.
Norman Bates.
They share a smile. Then Marion's quickly fades.
You're not really going to go out again and drive up to the diner, are you?
No.
Well, then would you do me a favor? Would you have dinner with me? I was just about to myself. You know, nothing special, just sandwiches and milk, but I'd like it very much if you'd come up to the house. I don't set a fancy table, but the kitchen's awful homey.
I'd like to.
All right, you get yourself settled and take off your wet shoes, and I'll be back as soon as it's ready.
He hands her the room key.
With my trusty umbrella.
He spins around and closes the door, leaving Marion alone in the room. She sets her black purse down, then heaves her large, hard-sided suitcase onto the bed. She opens it and unpacks a robe. Running the silky material through her fingers, she tosses it back into the suitcase and pulls the white envelope out of her purse. Fidgeting with a rubber band around the envelope, she scans the room. She turns around and opens a desk drawer, then glances up and quickly closes it. She strides to a short wooden bureau with round knobs, opens the top drawer, then looks up at the open window beside it. She closes that drawer and checks a small nightstand beside the bed. Biting her lip, she stands up straight and returns to her suitcase at the foot of the bed. She notices the newspaper sticking out of her purse and quickly pulls it out. Carefully, Marion unfolds the paper on top of her clothes in the suitcase. She removes the two stacks of $100 bills from the envelope, sets them neatly on the newspaper, and folds the paper back up around them. Then she places the innocent-looking newspaper roll on the nightstand.
No, I
Marion
can't.
Rushes to the open window.
I won't have you bringing strange young girls in for supper. By candlelight, I suppose, in the cheap erotic fashion of young men with cheap erotic minds.
Mother, please.
And then what? After supper, music? Whispers?
Mother, she's just a stranger. She's hungry and it's raining out.
Mother, she's just a stranger. As if men don't desire strangers. As if... Oh, I refuse to speak of disgusting things because they disgust me. You understand, boy? Go on, go tell her she'll not be appeasing her ugly appetite with my food or my son. Or do I have to tell her because you don't have the guts? Huh, boy? You have the guts, boy?
Shut up! Shut up!
Marion turns away from the window. She gazes back up at the big house on the hill and spies Norman walking down the steps with a tray in his hands. Marion walks over to the bed and, keeping her eyes on Norman out the window, she slips off her shoes and puts on fresh ones from her suitcase. Then she heads for the door. She stands on the porch with her hand on her hip in a relaxed pose. Norman rounds the corner and hesitates. He steps closer with his tray, which holds a pitcher and some plates of food.
I've caused you some trouble.
No. Mother, my mother, what is the phrase? She isn't quite herself today.
You shouldn't have bothered. I really don't have that much of an appetite.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wish you could apologize for other people.
Don't worry about it. But as long as you're fixed a supper, we may as well eat it.
She smiles and leans back in her open doorway. Norman, tall, thin, and youthfully handsome, steps forward, then retreats and sheepishly lowers his eyes.
It might be nicer and warmer in the office.
With a shy smile, he walks into the office, glancing back over his shoulder at Marion. Marion closes the door to her room. And she joins him in the office.
No, it stopped raining.
Eating in an office is just too officious. I have the parlor back here.
All right.
He leads her into the dark back room, sets the tray down, and turns on a lamp. Marion examines the decor. A huge owl with spread wings hangs from one corner. A long-beaked raven and other stuffed birds are perched on walls and tables.
Sit down.
Thank you.
They sit opposite each other.
You're very kind.
It's all for you.
I'm not hungry. Go ahead.
Marion cuts a small bite with her fork and eats it. Norman grins.
You eat like a bird.
You'd know, of course.
No, not really. Anyway, I hear the expression "eats like a bird." It is really a falsity, because birds really eat a tremendous lot. But I don't really know anything about birds. My hobby is stuffing things, you know, taxidermy. And I guess I'd just rather stuff birds because I hate the look of beasts when they're stuffed. You know, foxes and chimps. Some people even stuff dogs and cats, but, oh, I can't do that. I think only birds look well stuffed because they're kind of passive to begin with.
It's a strange hobby. Curious.
Uncommon, too.
Oh, I imagine so.
And it's not as expensive as you'd think. It's cheap, really. You know, needles, thread, sawdust. The chemicals are the only thing that cost anything.
A man should have a hobby.
Well, it's more than a hobby. A hobby's supposed to pass the time, not fill it.
Is your time so empty?
No. Well, I run the office and tend the cabins and grounds and do little errands for my mother, the ones she allows I might be capable of doing.
Do you go out with friends?
Norman tightens, then looks at Marion.
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
Marion discreetly lowers her gaze.
You've never had an empty moment in your entire life, have you?
Only my share.
Where are you going? I didn't mean to pry.
I'm looking for a private island.
What are you running away from?
Marion looks up and her eyes widen.
Why do you ask that?
No. People never run away from anything.
Norman quickly shifts his focus to a window.
The rain didn't last long, did it? You know what I think? I think that we're all in our private traps, clamped in them, and none of us can ever get out. We scratch and claw, but only at the air, only at each other. And for all of it, we never budge an inch.
Sometimes we deliberately step into those traps.
I was born in mine. I don't mind it anymore.
Oh, but you should. You should mind it.
Oh, I do. But I say I don't.
You know, if anyone ever talked to me the way I heard, the way she spoke to you.
Sometimes, when she talks to me like that, I feel I'd like to go up there and curse her and leave her forever. Or at least defy her.
Norman slumps back in his chair.
But I know I can't. She's ill.
She sounded strong.
No, I mean ill. She had to raise me all by herself after my father died. I was only 5, and it must have been quite a strain for her. She didn't have to go to work or anything like that. He left her a little money. Anyway, a few years ago, Mother met this man, and he talked her into building this motel. He could have talked her into anything. And when he died, too, it was just too great a shock for her. And the way he died...
He cracks a toothy smile.
I guess there's nothing to talk about while you're eating. Anyway, it was just too great a loss for her. She had nothing left.
Except you.
Well, a son is a poor substitute for a lover.
Why don't you go away?
To a private island like you?
No. Not like me.
I couldn't do that. Who'd look after her? She'd be alone up there. The fire would go out.
be cold and damp like a grave. If you love someone, you don't do that to them even if you hate them. You understand? I don't hate her. I hate what she's become. I hate the illness.
Wouldn't it be better if you put her someplace?
Norman's dark eyes flash, and he leans forward.
You mean an institution? A madhouse? People always call a madhouse someplace, don't they? Put her in someplace.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it to sound uncaring.
What do you know about caring? Have you ever seen the inside of one of those places? The laughing and the tears. And the cruel eyes studying you. My mother there. But she's harmless. She's as harmless as one of those stuffed birds.
I am sorry. I only felt... It seems she's hurting you. I meant well.
People always mean well. They cluck their thick tongues and shake their heads and suggest, oh, so very delicately.
His piercing eyes lock her in an unflinching stare. Then he eases back in his chair.
Of course, I've suggested it myself. But I hate to even think about it. She needs me. It's not as if she were a maniac, a raving thing. She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes. Haven't you?
Yes. Sometimes just one time can be enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Norman.
Norman.
She stands.
Oh, you're not going back to your room already?
I'm very tired. And I'll have a long drive tomorrow, all the way back to Phoenix.
Really?
I stepped into a private trap back there, and I'd like to go back and try to pull myself out of it. Before it's too late for me, too.
Are you sure you wouldn't like to stay just a little while longer? Just for talk?
I'd like to, but...
All right. Well, I'll see you in the morning. I'll bring you some breakfast, all right? What time?
Very early. Dawn.
All right, Miss...
Crane.
Crane, that's it.
Good night.
Marion leaves with a smile. Standing up, Norman watches her step onto the porch, then puts a piece of chewing gum in his mouth. In the office, Norman picks up the guest registry and checks Marion's entry. Marie Samuels, Los Angeles. His thin, gum-chewing lips smirk as he returns to the parlor and closes the door. He moves to the far wall and stands motionlessly beside a stuffed pheasant, listening to the adjacent wall. Norman wears a button-down Oxford shirt under his rumpled sport coat. Shadows from the lamplight accentuate his thin, angular face and dimpled chin. On the wall, an oil painting depicts two men and a voluptuous nude in a forest. Norman removes the painting, revealing a hole in the wallboard. He leans in and peers through a smaller hole in the inner wall at Marion. Clad only in her black slip and brassiere, Marion tosses her dress onto the bed. Norman's unflinching eye watches as the shapely blonde undresses and slips into her silky robe. Norman pulls back and returns the picture to its hook. Suddenly, Norman fires a piercing glare toward his house. With a clenched frown, he strides out of the parlor. He hesitates in the office doorway and again stares up toward the house. Thank you. dark clouds sweep across the night sky as Norman shoves his hands in his jacket pockets and climbs the stairs three at a time to the dark, imposing structure on the hill. Entering through an oversized front door, Norman strides through an elegant foyer to a staircase and stops. Slowly, Norman's shoulders slump. He slides his hand around an ornately carved wooden newel post and shuffles down a hallway. In the kitchen, Norman sits on the edge of a chair, awkwardly folds his long legs behind him, and fiddles with a sugar bowl. In cabin one, Marion works at the desk. She subtracts 700 from 40,000, then works out some figures from her bank book. With a sigh, she tears up the page of calculations. Stuffing the little scraps of paper into her fist, Marion looks down at the wastebasket, then hesitates and glances around the room. She stands up and adjusts her robe on her way to the bathroom, where she tosses the paper in the toilet. She closes the bathroom door and lets her robe slide off her shoulders, revealing her bare back. Taking off her slippers, she steps into the tub and draws the plastic shower curtain closed. Standing, she unwraps a fresh bar of soap. She turns the water on and lets the showerhead's powerful stream rain on her face. Grinning as the water cascades over her, Marion lathers the soap on her arms and shoulders. Her wet hair mats down against her head as she shuts her eyes under the shower's generous flow. Through the water-streaked, translucent shower curtain, we see the bathroom door open and a dark figure enter. Marion bathes, her back to the approaching figure, who suddenly pulls back the curtain, wielding a huge kitchen knife. The dark figure lunges forward with a knife. Marion tries to fight back as the attacker relentlessly hacks at her naked body. Dark blood splatters into the tub as the knife stabs into Marion's defenseless back. The attacker rushes out and we glimpse her dress and her gray hair tied in a bun. Marion slides against the shower tiles. With a drained, distant stare, she sinks down into the tub. The shower water pelts her as her mouth gapes and her chest heaves. Reaching out her right hand, Marion clutches the shower curtain. Suddenly she collapses forward over the edge of the tub, tearing the plastic curtain down. Water streaked with dark blood flows under Marion's feet and legs. The diluted mixture washes against the tub's clean white bottom and disappears as it turns a spiral down the open drain. The drain dissolves into Marion's open eye, centered by its dark pupil. Her thick, mascara-coated lashes remain still, her eyelid unblinking. Our view widens, revealing a few drops of water beaded on her smooth white skin, just below her eye and on her nose. She remains frozen in a wide-eyed stare, her nose and parted lips pressed against the bathroom's white tile floor. Our view glides up from Marion's lifeless face, past her robe on the toilet lid, into the bedroom. Her carefully folded newspaper lies on the nightstand. Our view glides across the floral wallpaper to the open window. A light shines from an upstairs room in the dark Victorian mansion.
Mother! Oh, God! Mother! Blood! Blood!
Norman charges out the front door and scrambles down the dark steps to the motel. Norman bursts into Marion's room, races to the bathroom, and freezes. He spins away from the door, knocking a picture off the wall. Pressed up against the wall, Norman clutches his hand over his mouth. Then he notices the open window and closes it. He sits on the bed. Trembling and jittery, Norman forces down a few uneasy swallows. With quick, shallow breaths, he walks across the room, shuts the outside door, and switches off the lights. He hurries out onto the porch. His face drawn and pale, Norman steadies himself against a square porch post. Calm washes over his quivering face. His stare narrows, and he steps into the office. Norman switches off the outside light, then the office goes dark. He steps out of the office with a mop and a bucket, slinks along the porch, and goes back into Marion's room. Once inside the dark room, he slowly approaches the bathroom. Silhouetted by the bright bathroom light, his square shoulders slump. He sets down the mop and bucket, then clenches his collar as he gazes at the body on the floor. Keeping his eyes on it, he turns off the shower. With a few nervous glances around the room, Norman takes hold of the shower curtain and slips it out from under Marion's heavy, limp arm. Blood pools on the white floor tiles. Norman lays the thin sheet of plastic on the bedroom rug. He carefully pulls it over the threshold to the bathroom floor and smooths it out. He steps back into the bathroom and crouches over the body. The bathroom door partially blocks our view as Norman grips Marion by the wrists, stands up straight, and slides her completely out of the tub. Walking backward, Norman drags the body across the bathroom floor and out onto the shower curtain. Stepping away, Norman lets Marion's hands drop, then notices his blood-covered palms. His thin nostrils flare and his face assumes a darkening frown as he steps into the bathroom and washes his hands in the sink. He wipes the sink clean as the blood washes from his hands. Wiping his hands dry on his jacket, he turns on the water in the bathtub, takes hold of the string mop, and wipes it around the inside of the tub. Streaks of dark blood wash easily off the tub's porcelain sides. Norman moves to the outside of the tub, where a trail of blood leads down and across the floor. After rinsing the mop, he finishes cleaning the floor and sets the mop aside. He grabs a bath towel from a towel rack, wipes down the shower wall with quick, deliberate circles, then finishes the tub and shuts off the water. Crouching down, his mouth hangs open as he wipes the tile floor clean. He tosses Marion's silky robe up on top of the toilet tank and wipes the floor around the john. Finished, he tosses the blood-stained towel into the mop bucket and places the string mop over it. Norman steps cautiously over Marion's body, walks across the dark bedroom and goes outside to the porch, where he stands gazing at Marion's boxy new sedan. He gets in the car. He pulls the light-colored sedan forward a little, then backs it up. The back tires strike the base of the porch, jolting the car slightly as Norman lines up the trunk with the door to cabin one. Bright moonlight illuminates the scene as Norman gets out with the keys, unlocks the trunk, and inspects its spacious, empty interior. Returning inside, Norman squats beside the body. He takes the edge of the plastic shower curtain and carefully folds it over the body, then does the same with the other side. Sliding his left arm under Marion's neck and his right arm under the bend of her knee, he rises to his feet, easily lifting the plastic-wrapped corpse. Marion's feet dangle out of the shower curtain as Norman carries her outside and lays her down in the trunk of her car. He lowers the trunk lid, but doesn't close it. With a leery stare, he checks to the left and right. Glancing over his shoulder once more, Norman returns to the bedroom, shuts the door, and switches on the light. He discovers the cabin key on the floor and slips it into his jacket pocket. Then he goes about cleaning the room. He takes Marion's coat out of the closet and stuffs it into her suitcase. He places her black purse in the suitcase as well and looks in the dressing table drawers. He spots Marion's bank book on the desk. He looks at it curiously, then adds it to the suitcase. He replaces the framed bird picture he knocked off the wall and picks up Marion's high heels from the floor. He gathers up her belt and bracelet on the bureau, then enters the bathroom. He grabs Marion's robe, checks the medicine cabinet, and carries the mop and bucket into the bedroom. As he stuffs everything into the suitcase and latches it shut, we glimpse the newspaper on the nightstand. Norman turns out the light and slowly opens the door, peering out into the moonlight. As he steps onto the porch, the headlights of a passing car shine across his face. He drops the mop, bucket, and suitcase. The car passes. Norman picks everything back up and pops the trunk open with his foot. Bending into the dark shadows behind the car, Norman sets down the mop and bucket, then picks up Marion's large suitcase and packs it into the trunk. Once again, Norman lowers the trunk lid, but doesn't close it. He goes back into the room for a last look around and spots the newspaper on the nightstand. Moving swiftly, he snatches the paper, switches off the bathroom light, and hurries out of the room. Closing the door behind himself, Norman tosses the newspaper into the trunk and closes the lid. He peers over his shoulder and gets into the car. He drives the big boxy sedan through the muddy parking area past the last row of rooms. Norman turns left, away from the road, and pulls in behind the motel. Marion's California license plate fills our view, NFB 418. The car inches slowly forward, revealing its wide trunk, chrome bumper, and round brake lights set into triangular tail fins. Surrounded by tall swamp grass, the car stops. Norman opens his door and carefully backs out of the car. Taking hold of the frame around the driver's side window, he pushes the car forward. Immediately, it pitches downward and rolls through the grass into a swamp. With a final shove on the left tail fin, Norman stands at the edge of the swamp and watches the car sink. Illuminated by pale moonlight, thick black mud oozes up the sides of the car, swallowing the hood and reaching the base of the windows. Norman folds and refolds his hands as he watches. Then his gum chewing stops, and the car stops sinking. The car's roof, rear window, and trunk lid hang suspended above the mud. Norman jerks his head to the right and looks around. Black fingers of mud envelop the trunk and drag the car deeper. Air bubbles pop around the square roof as the last evidence of the car disappears into the murky swamp. Norman's mouth twitches in a satisfied grin, and the scene fades to black. The scene changes to Sam composing a letter on his stationery, which begins, "Dearest, write as always, Marion." We move back from Sam at his desk, past a display of iron rakes and bags of peat moss. A customer reads the label on a tin of poison to a young store clerk.
They tell you what its ingredients are and how it's guaranteed to exterminate every insect in the world. But they do not tell you whether or not it's painless. And I say, insect or man, death should always be painless. Suppose this one seems to claim more.
Outside, a woman steps out of a car. Dressed in a tailored wool skirt suit, she has short blonde hair and a smooth oval face. She carries her coat and a small suitcase into the hardware store and approaches the clerk.
Sam?
Sam? Lady wants to see you.
Sam emerges from the back room. Tall and strapping, he flashes the woman a smile.
Yes, miss?
I'm Marion's sister.
Sure, Lila.
Is Marion here?
Of course not.
Thank you.
Something wrong?
The customer leaves while Lila glares at Sam.
She left home on Friday. I was in Tucson over the weekend, and I haven't heard from her since. Not even a phone call. Look, if you two are in this thing together, I don't care. It's none of my business. But I want to talk to Marion, and I want her to tell me it's none of my business, and then I'll go...
Bob, run out and get yourself some lunch, will you?
That's okay, Sam. I brought it with me.
Run out and eat it.
Bob shrugs and leaves. A man with a brooding gaze slips unnoticed inside the front door.
What thing could we be in together?
Sorry about the tears.
Well, is Marion in trouble? What is it?
Let's all talk about Marion, shall we?
The brooding man wears a dark suit and fedora.
Who are you, friend?
My name is Arbogast, friend. I'm a private investigator.
He shows them an ID.
Where is she, Miss Crane?
I don't know you.
Well, I know you don't. Because if you did, I wouldn't be able to follow you.
What's your interest in this?
Well, $40,000.
$40,000.
That's right.
Sam looks at Lila, then back to Arbogast.
Well, one of you better tell me what's going on and tell me fast. I can take just so much of this nonsense.
Take it easy, friend. Take it easy. It's just that your girlfriend stole $40,000.
What are you talking about?
What is this?
She was supposed to bank it on Friday for her boss, and she didn't. And no one has seen her since.
Someone has seen her. Someone always sees a girl with $40,000.
Sam, they don't want to prosecute. They just want the money back. Sam, if she's here...
She isn't. She isn't.
Miss Crane, can I ask you a question? Did you come up here on just a hunch and nothing more?
Not even a hunch, just hope.
Well, with a little checking, I could get to believe you.
I don't care if you believe me or not. All I want to do is see Marion before she gets in this too deeply.
Did you check in Phoenix? Hospitals? Maybe she had an accident. Or a holdup.
No, she was seen leaving town in her own car. By her employer, I might add.
Can't believe it. Can you?
She looks down.
Well, you know, we're always quickest to doubt people who have a reputation for being honest. I think she's here, Miss Crane. But there's a boyfriend. Well, she's not back there with the nuts and bolts, but she's here in this town somewhere. I'll find her. I'll be seeing you.
He nods and walks out. Later, he continues his investigation, stopping first at a hotel. Next, he questions elderly women who have rooms for rent. They shake their heads no. Later still, he enters a hotel with a brick facade. Now outside the office of the Bates Motel, Norman sits in a hard-backed chair reading a magazine. He's dressed in dark corduroys and a thin black wool sweater. Munching candy from a small paper bag, he watches Arbogast pull up to the motel and get out of his car.
Evening.
Evening.
I almost drove right past.
I'm always forgetting to turn the sign on, but we do have a vacancy. 12, in fact. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies. Candy?
No, thanks. Last 2 days, I've been to so many motels, my eyes are blurry with neon, but you know, this is the first place it looks like it's hiding from the world.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I didn't really forget to turn the sign on. It just doesn't seem like any use anymore, you know?
Uh-huh.
See, that used to be the main highway right there. Well, want to come in and register?
No. Sit down. I don't want to trouble you. I just want to ask you a few questions.
No, it's no trouble. Today's linen day. I always change the beds here once a week, whether they've been used or not. Hate the smell of dampness, don't you? It's such a, I don't know, creepy smell. Come on.
They go into the office.
You out to buy a motel?
No.
reason I asked, you said you'd seen so many in the past couple of days, I thought maybe you, what was it you wanted to ask?
Well, you see, I'm looking for a missing person. My name's Arbogast. I'm a private investigator. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to trace a girl that's been missing for about a week now from Phoenix. It's a private matter. The family wants to forgive her. She's not in any trouble.
I didn't think the police went looking for people who aren't in trouble.
Oh, I'm not the police.
Oh, yeah.
We have reason to believe that she came along this way, may have stopped in the area. Did she stop here?
Well, no one stopped here for a couple of weeks.
Do you mind looking at the picture before committing yourself?
Commit myself? You sure talk like a policeman.
Look at the picture, please.
Norman looks and shakes his head. Mm-hmm.
Sure?
Yeah.
Well, she may have used an alias. Marion Crane's a real name, but she could have registered under a different one.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't even much bother with guests registering anymore. You know, one by one, you drop the formalities. I shouldn't even bother changing the sheets, but old habits die hard. Which reminds me.
He flicks a light switch.
What's that?
It's the light, the sign. We had a couple last week said if the thing hadn't been on, they would have thought this was an old deserted...
Well, you see, that's exactly my point. You said that nobody had been here for a couple of weeks, and there's a couple came by and... They didn't know that you were open.
Yeah.
Well, as you say, old habits die hard. It's possible this girl could have registered under another name. Do you mind if I look at your book?
No.
Norman hands him the guest registry and pops some candy into his mouth.
Get the date somewhere.
See, there's nobody.
So I have a sample of her handwriting.
He unfolds some paper.
Oh, yes. Here we are. Marie Samuels. That's an interesting address.
Is that her?
Yeah, I think so. Marie. Marion. Samuels. Your boyfriend's name is Sam. Mm-hmm. Was she in disguise, by any chance?
Norman swallows his candy.
You want to check the picture again?
Look, I wasn't lying to you, Mr.
Oh, I know that. I know you wouldn't lie.
You know, it's tough keeping track of the time
around. Oh, I know.
Norman looks at the picture.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was raining, and her hair was all wet. I tell you, it's not really a very good picture, really.
No, I guess not. Well, tell me all about her.
Well, she arrived rather late one night, and she went straight to sleep and left early the next morning.
Well, how early?
Oh, very early.
Mm-hmm. Which morning was that?
The next morning, Sunday.
I see. Mm-hmm. Did anyone meet her here?
No.
Did she arrive with anyone?
No.
Did she make any phone calls or...
No.
Locally? Mm-hmm. Did you spend the night with her?
Norman's grin fades.
No.
Well, then, how would you know that she didn't make any phone calls?
Well, she was very tired and, see, now I'm starting to remember it. I'm making a mental picture of it in my mind. You know, if you make a mental picturization of something...
That's right. Take your time.
She was sitting back there. No, she was standing back there with a sandwich in her hand. And she said she had to go to sleep early because she had a long drive ahead of her.
Mm-hmm. Back where?
Back where she came from.
No, you said before that she was sitting back there.
Oh,
standing.
Yes, but back in my parlor there. She was very hungry, and I made her a sandwich. And then she said that she was tired, and she had to go right to bed.
Oh, I see. How did she pay you? Cash, check?
Cash.
Mm-hmm. And after she left, she didn't come back.
Hmm. Well, why should she? Well, Mr. Arbogast, I guess that's about it. I've got some work to do, if you don't mind.
Well, to tell you the truth, I do mind. You see, if it doesn't gel, it isn't aspic, and this ain't gelling. It's not coming together. Something's missing.
Well, I don't know what you could expect me to know. People just come and go, you know.
That's right. She isn't still here, is she?
No.
If I wanted to, check the cabins, all 12 of them. I'd need a wand, wouldn't I?
Listen, if you don't believe me, come on with me. You can help me change beds, okay?
Okay. No, thanks.
They head outside. Peering over his shoulder, Arbogast watches Norman hesitate at the first door, then move to the second. Arbogast looks out and spies a figure silhouetted in the second floor window of the Bates house.
Change your mind?
Norman strides over to him with a smile.
You know, I think I must have one of those faces you just can't help believing.
Is anyone at home?
No.
Oh, there's somebody sitting up in the window.
No, there isn't.
Oh, sure, go ahead, take a look.
Oh, that must be my mother. She's an invalid. It's practically like living alone.
Oh, I see. Now, if this girl, Marion Crane, were here, you wouldn't be hiding her, would you?
No.
Not if she paid you well?
No.
Let's just say for the sake of argument that she wanted you to gallantly protect her. You'd know that you were being used, that you wouldn't be made a fool of, would you?
But I'm not a fool.
Well,
and I'm not capable of being fooled, not even by a woman.
Well, this is not a slur on your manhood. I'm sorry.
Let's put it this way. She might have fooled me, but she didn't fool my mother.
Well, then your mother met her. Could I talk to your mother?
No, as I told you, she's confined. And...
Yes, but just for a few minutes, that's all. There might be some hint that you missed out on. You know, sick old women are usually pretty sharp.
Mr. Arbogast.
I wouldn't disturb her.
I think I've talked to you all I want to.
Yes, but
so
just for...
I think it'd be much better if you left now. Thanks.
Well, all right. You sure would save me a lot of legwork if you let me talk to her. Would I need a warrant for that, too?
Sure.
Uh-huh. All right. Thanks anyway.
He walks to his car. Norman, still holding a set of sheets in his arms, leans against the office window and watches Arbogast leave. Evening shadows darken half of Norman's thin, boyish face. As Arbogast drives away, Norman's lips twitch and curl up in a contained, smirking grin. Nighttime. Arbogast stops at a telephone booth. He steps inside, folds the door closed, and thumbs through a small notebook. Finding a coin in his coat pocket, the private eye picks up the receiver, drops the coin into the slot, and dials.
Oh, hello, Loomis. This is Arbogast. Is Lila there? Good, let me talk to her, please. Hello, Lila. Lila, listen. Marion was up here. Yeah, she spent last Saturday night at the Bates Motel. It's right out here on the old highway. I even know what cabin she was in. It was number one. Well, this young fellow that runs the place said that she just spent the night, left the next day, and that was it. No, not exactly. Well, I did question him, believe me, but I think I got all there was to get. I'll just have to pick up the pieces from here. Well, I tell you, I don't feel entirely satisfied. See, this boy had a sick old mother. I think she saw Marion and talked to her. No, unfortunately, he wouldn't let me see her. Well, I was, but I think I'll go back to the motel first. No, you stay there with Loomis. I'll be back in about an hour. All right, fine. Listen, you'll be happy to know what I think. I think our friend, Sam Loomis, didn't know that Marion was here. Yeah. All right, see you in about an hour, or less. Right,
in the moonlight, we view the Bates Motel. Norman steps out of the office and strides along the porch past each room. He stops for a moment and looks up toward the road. Then he continues to the last four rooms, which are set at a right angle to the others, forming an L. Just as Norman disappears into the corner room, Arbogast pulls up. He slides across his front seat and gets out the passenger's side door. Clad in his dark suit and felt hat, Arbogast heads toward the well-lit office. Set against dark rounded hills, the large Victorian house towers over the motel. Light shines in the same upper left-hand window. Now the private eye steps onto the porch and into the office.
Bates?
Peering into the parlor, Arbogast steps behind the counter and stops in the doorway. His eyes widen at the stuffed raven and the spread-winged owl. His roving eyes notice a small floor safe beside a bookcase, its door left open. He kneels down and looks inside. Finding nothing, he turns his attention back to the office, where he makes a quick inspection under the counter. Arbogast returns to the porch, where his eyes fall on the Bates house. With a quick glance toward the rest of the rooms, Arbogast starts up the stairs to the house. The stone staircase leads up the landscaped hill to the left, then turns at a right angle up the hill to the porch. On the porch, fancy spindles support a railing between each of the carved porch posts. Ornate woodwork also decorates the top of the porch. Arbogast approaches the wide front door, which is flanked by two tall, narrow windows. A faint light shows behind their gauzy curtains. Arbogast takes a cautionary look back down to the cabins, then opens the front door. Having removed his hat, Arbogast shows his high forehead and dark, slicked hair. He enters the foyer and closes the door behind him. He shifts his heavy-lidded eyes to a hallway. Framed paintings and vases decorate an elegant, dimly lit passage. His eyes shift to the staircase, then over to a closed door. With his hat in his hands, he takes a breath and starts up the carpeted stairs. Moving his hand along the dark wooden banister, he climbs step by step. Upstairs, a door slowly hinges open, spilling light onto the oriental rug in the hallway. Unaware, Arbogast reaches the top of the stairs. Suddenly, a woman in a dress marches out of the room with a huge kitchen knife. She plunges the knife into Arbogast's chest. Flailing his arms, he stumbles backward down the stairs. He hits the floor, and the old woman pounces on him with quick, powerful stabs. Now in the hardware store.
Sometimes Saturday night has a lonely sound. Ever notice that, Lila?
She whips around in her chair.
Sam, he said an hour or less.
Yeah. It's been three.
Well, are we just going to sit here and wait?
He'll be back. Let's sit still and hang on, okay?
Lila puts out her cigarette, then stands up and faces Sam.
How far is the old highway?
You want to go out there, don't you? Busted on Arbogast, the old lady, maybe
yes.
Shake her up?
Yes.
That wouldn't be a wise thing to do.
Patience doesn't run in my family, Sam. I'm going out there.
Look, Arbogast,
Sam. An hour or less.
Sam sits at his desk and picks up the phone.
Well, I'm going.
You'll never find it.
He throws on his coat and starts out.
Stay here.
Why can't I go with you?
I don't know. One of us has to be here in case he's on the way.
What am I supposed to do? Just sit here and wait?
Yeah. Stay here.
He walks out, leaving Lila in the dark store. Behind her, a display of leaf rakes fans out over her head as she crosses her arms. Now, in the twilight, Norman stands at the edge of the swamp beside a tree, while Sam peers into the dark office window. Sam steps off the porch past his black pickup truck.
Arbogast! Arbogast!
He raises his hand to his mouth.
Arbogast! Arbogast! Arbogast!
Standing beside the swamp, Norman listens. His hand slipped casually into his pockets, he turns his face toward the cabins. A dark shadow cuts across his lean jaw and piercing eyes. Now Lila sits in Sam's room in the back of the hardware store. She hurries into the dark store and up the center aisle to the door, where she meets Sam as he enters.
He didn't come back here.
Sam?
No Arbogast, no Bates. Only the old lady at home. Sick old lady unable to answer the door, or unwilling.
Where could he have gone?
Maybe he got some definite lead. Maybe he went right on.
Without calling me?
In a hurry.
Sam, he called when he had nothing, nothing but a dissatisfied feeling. Don't you think he'd have called if he had anything at all?
Yes, I think he would have. Let's go see Al Chambers.
Who's he?
Our deputy sheriff around here.
All right, let me get my coat.
Later, Sam and Lila wait in a living room with Mrs. Chambers as the jowly deputy sheriff walks downstairs in his bathrobe.
Good evening. Well, I don't know where to start, except at the beginning.
Yes.
This is Lila Crane from Phoenix.
How do you do?
She's been here searching for her sister. There's this private detective helping, and... Well, we got a call from this detective saying that he traced her to that motel out on the old highway.
That must be the Bates Motel.
He traced her there and called us to say he was going to question Mrs. Bates.
Norman took a wife?
No, I don't think so. An old woman. His mother. Well, anyway, that was early this evening. We haven't seen or heard from him since.
Now, your sister's missing how long?
Well, she left Phoenix a week ago yesterday without a trace.
How'd you and this detective come to trace her to Fairvale?
I thought she'd be coming to me.
Left Phoenix under her own steam?
Yes.
She's not missing so much as she's run away.
That's right.
From what?
Lila takes a breath.
She stole some money.
A lot?
$40,000.
And the police haven't been able to...
Everyone concerned thought, you know, if they could get her to give the money back, they could avoid involving her with the police.
It explains the private detective. He traced her to the Bates place. What exactly did he say when he called you?
Well, he said that Marion was there and for one night, and then she left.
With the $40,000?
We didn't say anything about the money. It isn't important what he said on the phone, is it? He was supposed to come back here and talk to us after he talked to the mother, and he didn't. That's what I want you to do something about.
Like what?
I'm sorry if I seem overanxious. It's just that I'm sure there's something wrong out there, and I have to know what.
Well, I think there's something wrong too, miss. But not the same thing. I think what's wrong is your private detective. I think he got himself a hot lead as to where your sister was going. Probably from Norman Bates. Called you to keep you still while he took off after her and the money.
No. He said he was dissatisfied and he was going back there.
Why don't you call Norman and let him say just what happened?
At this hour?
Well, he was out when I was there just a while ago. If he's back, he probably isn't even in bed yet.
He wasn't out when you were there. He just wasn't answering the door in the dead of night like some people do. This fellow lives like a hermit. You must remember that bad business out there about 10 years ago.
Please, call.
Mrs. Chambers picks up the phone and dials.
Florrie, the sheriff wants you to connect him with the Bates Motel.
She hands the phone to her husband.
Norman? Sheriff Chambers. Yeah. I've been just fine, thanks. Listen, we got worries here. Have you had a fellow stop by there tonight? Well, this one wouldn't be a customer anyway. A private detective. Name of...
Arbogast.
Arbogast. And after he left? No, that's okay, Norman. This detective was there. Norman told him about the girl. The detective thanked him, and he went away.
And he didn't come back? He didn't see the mother?
Your detective told you he couldn't come right back because he was going to question Norman Bates' mother, right?
Yes.
Norman Bates' mother has been dead and buried in Green Lawn Cemetery for the past 10 years.
I helped Norman pick out the dress she was buried in. Periwinkle blue.
It ain't only local history, Sam. It's the only case of murder and suicide on Fairvale ledgers. Mrs. Bates poisoned this guy. She was... involved with when she found out he was married, then took a helping to the same stuff herself. Strychnine. Ugly way to die.
Norman found them dead together. In bed.
You mean that old woman I saw sitting in the window out there wasn't Bates' mother?
Now, wait a minute, Sam. Are you sure you saw an old woman?
Yes, in the house behind the motel. I called and pounded, but she just ignored me.
You want to tell me you saw Norman Bates' mother?
But it had to be. Because Arbogast said so, too. And the young man wouldn't let him see her because she was too ill.
Well, if the woman up there is Mrs. Bates, who's that woman buried out in Green Lawn Cemetery?
In the office parlor of the Bates Motel, Norman puts the phone down. His jaw chews steadily on a piece of gum as he shuts the parlor lights off and heads outside. He jogs up the stairs to the house, where a light shines from the upstairs window. He enters the house, crosses the dark foyer, and heads up the wide staircase at a casual pace. At the top of the stairs, he turns left, opens the door, and goes inside. Our view glides up the stairs, but remains in the hallway. Looking down from the ceiling, we glimpse the slightly ajar bedroom door.
Now, Mother, I'm gonna bring something up.
I am sorry, boy, but you do manage to look ludicrous when you give me orders.
Please, Mother.
No, I will not hide in the fruit cellar. You think I'm fruity, huh? I'm staying right here. This is my room, and no one will drag me out of it. Least of all, my big, bold son.
They'll come now, Mother. He came after the girl, and now someone will come after him. Mother, please, it's just for a few days. Just for a few days so they won't find you.
Just for a few days? In that dark, dank fruit cellar? No! You hid me there once, boy, and you won't do it again. Not ever again. Now get out! I told you to get out, boy.
I'll carry you, Mother.
Norman, what do you think you're doing? Don't you touch me! Don't! Norman!
Norman hurries out of the room with his old mother in his arms.
Put me down. Put me down. I can walk on my own.
Morning. Sam and Lila meet Sheriff and Mrs. Chambers as they leave church.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We thought if you didn't mind, we'd drive out to that motel with you.
He's already been.
Went out for service.
Did you two have breakfast?
You didn't find anything.
Nothing. It's cleared away here.
Well, what did he say about my sister?
Just what he told your detective. She used a fake name. Saw the register myself. Saw the whole place, as a matter of fact. That boy's alone there.
No mother.
You must have seen an illusion, Sam. I know you're not the seeing illusions type. But no woman was there, and I don't believe in ghosts, so there it is.
I still feel that there's something.
I see you do. I'm sorry I couldn't make you feel better. You want to come around to my office this afternoon and report a missing person and a theft is what you want to do. The sooner you drop this in the lap of the law, that's the sooner you stand a chance of your sister being picked up. How about that?
I don't know.
It's Sunday. Come on over to the house and do your reporting around dinner time. It'll make it nicer. You too, Sam.
Thank you.
They watch the Chambers leave.
Maybe I am the seeing illusions type.
No, you're not.
Well, you want me to drop you at the hotel or...
Sam, I still won't feel satisfied until I go out there.
Neither will I. Come on.
Later in the car.
We better decide what we're going to say or do when we walk in there.
We're going to register as man and wife. We're going to get shown to a cabin. And then we're going to search every inch of the place, inside and out.
In Sam's black pickup truck, they pull up to the rustic Bates Motel. Norman pulls back a lacy curtain and watches them from the house. Sam wears a dark suit and tie, while Lila wears a skirt suit and a long coat. She gazes up at Norman's window, then joins Sam coming out of the office.
I wonder where Norman Bates does his hermiting.
Someone's at that window. I just saw the curtain move.
Norman skips to the bottom of the stone steps with a smile.
Well?
Just coming up to ring for you.
Uh-huh. Suppose you want a room.
We were going to try to make it straight to San Francisco, but we don't like the look of that sky. Looks like a bad day coming, doesn't it?
Okay.
Norman hops onto the porch and into the office, where he takes a key from the board.
I'll take you to cabin 10.
Better sign in first, hadn't we?
No, that's not necessary.
My boss is paying for this trip, and, well, it's 90% business. He wants practically notarized receipts. I better sign in and get a receipt.
As Norman bends down to get the guest registry, Sam's pleasant smile turns into a suspicious frown. Norman opens the book and hands him a fountain pen. As Sam signs in, Lila glances at the entries in the book, then trades a smile with Norman. Sam finishes.
Thank you.
Norman puts the book away.
I'll get your bags.
Haven't any.
He locks Norman in a stare.
I'll show you the room, then.
First time I've ever seen it happen. You check in any other place in this country without bags, and you have to pay in advance.
$10.
Sam offers a slight smile. Norman cracks a nervous grin. Sam hands over the money.
That receipt.
Norman gives a compliant nod and reaches under the counter. Lila picks up the room key.
I'll go on ahead.
Outside, Lila opens the door to cabin one, then quickly shuts it.
All right, there's your receipt. Now I'll show you the cabin.
Don't bother yourself. We'll find it.
Norman stands in the doorway and watches them with stern, dark eyes. Sam joins Lila halfway down the porch. Together, they enter the third cabin from the end. Inside, Sam sits on the bed with his back to Lila.
Sam, we have to go into that cabin and search it, no matter what we're afraid of finding or how much it may hurt.
I know. Do you think if something happened, it happened there?
I don't know. But if you had a useless business like this motel, what would you need to get out, to get a new business somewhere else? $40,000?
Sam stares at her.
How could we prove that? Well, if he opens a motel on the new highway, say it.
There must be some proof that exists now. Something that proves he got that money away from Marion somehow.
What makes you sound so certain?
Arbogast. He liked me, Sam. Or he felt sorry for me, and he was beginning to feel the same way about you. I could tell the last time I talked to him on the phone. He wouldn't have gone anywhere or done anything without telling us unless he was stopped. And he was stopped. So he must have found out something.
We'll start with cabin one.
He opens the door and hesitates.
If he sees us, we're just taking the air.
They step out onto the porch and walk back toward the office. Walking side by side, they pass each cabin. Every blind is drawn and every door is shut. Metal easy chairs sit vacant outside some of the rooms. Lila stops at the door to cabin one, while Sam continues to the next door and pokes his head inside the office.
Bates.
He goes inside. Sam reemerges alone and follows Lila into the first cabin. Sam closes the door behind them, and the room grows dark. Lila goes to work looking in the closet, while Sam pulls out the writing desk drawer. He moves to the dressing table and checks every drawer. Lila looks in the small bureau beside the window. Sam kneels down beside the crisply made bed and investigates the nightstand. Finally, Lila goes into the bathroom. Sam follows her in and gazes at the empty metal rings dangling from the shower curtain rod.
No shower curtain.
Sam!
A scrap of paper in the toilet.
It's figuring. It didn't get washed down. Look, some figure has been added to or subtracted from 40,000. That proves Marion was here. To be too wild to go.
Bates never denied she was here.
Well, doesn't that prove that he found out about the money?
Do we simply ask him where he's hidden it?
No. But that old woman, whoever she is, she told Arbogast something. I want her to tell us the same thing.
Sam grabs her arm.
You can't go up there.
Why not?
Bates.
Well, let's find him. One of us can keep him occupied while the other gets to the old woman.
He'll never be able to hold him still if he doesn't want to be held. I don't like you going to that house alone.
I can handle a sick old woman.
All right, I'll find Bates and keep him occupied. Wait a minute. If you get anything out of the mother, can you find your way back to town?
Yes, of course.
If you do get anything, don't stop to tell me.
Sam opens the door and peers outside. Lila slides out beside him and checks the porch herself. Then she heads back to their cabin. Sam closes the door to cabin one and takes a few steps toward the office, where Norman stands waiting inside. Sam blocks his view.
You looking for me?
Why, yes, as a matter of fact. Wife's taking a nap, and I never could keep quiet enough for her, so I just thought I'd look you up and talk.
Good. You're satisfied with your cabin?
Oh, it's fine.
They stand nose to nose in the doorway. Norman backs off, and Sam gestures to Lila behind his back. Lila sneaks behind the motel to a junk pile. Standing beside stacks of old wooden crates and an abandoned Model T, She gazes up at the house. The massive three-story mansion is capped by a square, sloping mansard roof. Lila leaves a dusty path as she heads straight up the hill into tall, untended grass. As she climbs, her focus on the imposing structure closes in, from its rectangular central tower down to the front porch, and finally to the front door. Lila climbs the porch steps, her eyes locked on the wide front door. The gauzy curtains shield her view of the inside as she reaches for the knob. The door swings open, and Lila steps into the foyer. She gazes down the hallway at a stained glass window, then inspects a bronze Cupid on a pedestal. She closes the door. In the office, Sam leans on the counter, staring down Norman, who stands with his foot propped on the desk.
I've been doing all the talking so far, haven't I? I thought it was the people who were alone most of the time who did all the talking when they got the chance. Here you are doing all the listening. You're alone here, aren't you? Mm-hmm. Drive me crazy.
I think that would be a rather extreme reaction, don't you?
Just an expression. What I meant was, I'd do just about anything to get away. Wouldn't you?
No.
In the house, Lila reaches the upstairs bedroom and knocks.
Mrs. Bates?
Lila opens the door and stops. Her lips slightly parted, she gazes in wonder at the bedroom, decorated with thick draperies, elegantly striped wallpaper, and ornate Victorian furniture. She notices an immaculately clean marble sink with an unused bar of soap. Nearby, an armchair rests beside a carved, multi-layered mantel. Lila steps further into the room and opens a large armoire. She stares at the dresses and furs hung inside, below a shelf of women's hats. Then her eyes fall on a bronze sculpture of folded hands on a pillow. Lila studies the hands' long fingers and smooth skin. Suddenly, she spots someone behind her. She swings around and discovers her own reflection in a full-length mirror. Lila's eyes narrow as she looks down at the neatly made bed beside her. Indented in the mattress is a deep curve, shaped like a person lying on her side. Lila bends down and touches the indented pillow. Now in the office.
I'm not saying you shouldn't be contented here. I'm just doubting that you are. I think if you saw a chance to get out from under, you'd unload this place.
This place? This place happens to be my only world. I grew up in that house up there. I had a very happy childhood. My mother and I were more than happy.
In the house, Lila reaches the top of another staircase. She stops at a closed door, peers back down the stairs, then enters the room. Near the ceiling of the small room, a stenciled border depicts merry-go-rounds and elephants. On one shelf, Lila notices a doll and antique toy cars. A tattered stuffed rabbit sits on a child's bed. She frowns. The pillow and quilt are rumpled and sleep-tossed. On a table beside the bed, a dozen records are stacked next to a record player. Lila reads the label of the record on the turntable, Beethoven's Eroica. Near the door, Lila finds a bookshelf with a small globe on top of it. She selects a hardcover book marked only with a golden diamond on either end of the leather spine. She opens it, and her squinting eyes widen as she reads. Meanwhile, Sam and Norman stand locked in a fierce gaze.
You look frightened. Have I been saying something frightening?
I don't know what you've been saying.
I've been talking about your mother, about your motel. How are you going to do it?
Do what?
Buy a new one. In a new town where you won't have to hide your mother.
Why don't you just get in your car and drive away from here, okay?
Where will you get the money to do that, Bates? Or do you already have it? Socked away.
Shut up!
A lot of it. $40,000.
Norman retreats into the parlor. Sam follows.
I bet your mother knows where the money is and what you did to get it. I think she'll tell us.
Norman spins around.
Where's that girl you came here with? Where is she?
He throws back the window curtains and peers out. As Lila walks downstairs inside the house, Norman bashes Sam in the head with a ceramic jar. Sam falls, and Norman races out. From the foyer of the house, Lila spots Norman charging up the hill. She hurries down the hallway to a stairwell leading to the cellar. She crouches down as the front door opens. Norman enters, looks around, then bounds upstairs. Lila starts back up to the foyer, then glances down at the cellar door. She scans the stairway once more, then walks down and opens the cellar door. Peering through the dark cellar shadows, Lila opens the door to another room and stops. Under a bare light bulb, an old woman sits with her back to Lila next to a barrel of apples. The woman wears a shawl around her shoulders and her gray hair tied in a bun.
Mrs. Bates.
Lila reaches out and touches the woman's shoulder. The chair swivels around, revealing a shriveled-headed corpse. Lila gapes at the skull's hollow eye sockets and lipless, tooth-filled grin. She whirls around as a gangly woman with a maniacal grin charges into the room, wielding a huge kitchen knife. Sam bursts in and grabs the lunging attacker. In the struggle, Sam clutches the knife and knocks a wig from the attacker's head. It's Norman. Norman twists and squirms in Sam's powerful grasp. Lila watches as Norman's dress tears, revealing his Oxford shirt underneath. Sam wrestles the knife away, and our view returns to the wrinkled, grinning skull of Norman's dead mother. Now at the county courthouse, policemen mill outside an office where Sheriff Chambers sits with Sam and Lila and others.
Well, if anyone gets any answers, it'll be the psychiatrist. Even I couldn't get to Norman. He knows me.
A man in a gray suit enters the room.
Did he talk to you?
No. I got the whole story, but not from Norman.
I got it from his mother. Norman Bates no longer exists. He only half existed to begin with. And now, the other half has taken over. Probably for all time.
Lila leans forward.
Did he kill my sister?
Yes. And no.
Well, now, look, if you're trying to lay some psychiatric groundwork for some sort of plea, this fellow would like to cop this.
A psychiatrist doesn't lay the groundwork. He merely tries to explain it.
But my sister is...
Yes. Yes, I'm sorry. The private investigator, too. If you drag that swamp somewhere in the vicinity of the motel, you...
With a pondering blink, he turns to one of the men.
Have you any unsolved missing persons cases on your books?
Yes, two.
Young girls.
Did he confess to...
Like I said, the mother. Now, to understand it the way I understood it, hearing it from the mother, that is, from the mother half of Norman's mind, you have to go back 10 years to the time when Norman murdered his mother and her lover. Now, he was already dangerously disturbed. Had been ever since his father died. His mother was a clinging, demanding woman. And for years, the two of them lived as if there was no one else in the world. Then she met a man. And it seemed to Norman that she threw him over for this man. Now that pushed him over the line and he killed them both. Matricide is probably the most unbearable crime of all. Most unbearable to the son who commits it. So he had to erase the crime, at least in his own mind. He stole her corpse. A weighted coffin was buried. He hid the body in the fruit cellar. Even treated it to keep it as well as it would keep. And that still wasn't enough. She was there. But she was a corpse. So he began to think and speak for her. Give her half his life, so to speak. At times, he could be both personalities, carry on conversations. At other times, the mother half took over completely. He was never all Norman. But he was often only mother. And because he was so pathologically jealous of her, he assumed that she was as jealous of him. Therefore, If he felt a strong attraction to any other woman, the mother's side of him would go wild.
He points at Lila.
When he met your sister, he was touched by her, aroused by her. He wanted her. That set off the jealous mother, and mother killed the girl. Now, after the murder, Norman returned as if from a deep sleep. And like a dutiful son, covered up all traces of the crime he was convinced his mother had committed.
Why was he dressed like that?
He's a transvestite.
Not exactly. A man who dresses in women's clothing in order to achieve a sexual change or satisfaction is a transvestite. But in Norman's case, he was simply doing everything possible to keep alive the illusion of his mother being alive. And when reality came too close, when danger or desire threatened that illusion, he'd dress up, even to a cheap wig he bought. He'd walk about the house, sit in her chair, speak in her voice. He tried to be his mother. And, now he is. Now, that's what I meant when I said I got the story from the mother. You see, when the mind houses two personalities, there's always a conflict, a battle. In Norman's case, the battle is over, and the dominant personality has won.
And the $40,000? Who got that?
The swamp. These were crimes of passion, not profit.
A guard enters.
He feels a little chill. Can I bring him this blanket?
Sure. All right.
The officer nods and backs out of the room. He walks down the hall, where another officer unlocks a door and stands guard outside while he brings the blanket into the room.
Thank you.
The officer leaves, and the guard locks the door. Inside, Norman wraps himself in the blanket, his lips unmoving.
It's sad when a mother has to speak the words that condemn her own son. But I couldn't allow them to believe that I would commit murder. They'll put him away now, as I should have, years ago. He was always bad. And in the end, he intended to tell them I killed those girls and that man. As if I could do anything except just sit and stare, like one of his stuffed birds. Well, they know I can't even move a finger, and I won't. I'll just sit here and be quiet, just in case they do suspect me.
A fly crawls across Norman's thumb.
They're probably watching me. Well, let them. Let them see what kind of a person I am. I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
Norman's crazed stare and twitching grin fade into a ghostly skull. Now a chain winch pulls Marion's sedan out of the muddy swamp. Black lines cut the image away. The end. This film has been described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH, Boston. Described by Brian Gould. Descriptions read by Peter Haydu. Funding provided by the United States Department of Education. For more information about DVS, call toll-free 1-800-333-1203 or write to our email address, dvs@wgbh.org.